Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about people, politics and pragmatism. To quote Mark Twain, the people have spoken, the bastards. In the biggest political earthquake of our lifetimes, Britain has voted for Brexit. We're going to be analysing why that's happened. Me and Steve Haynes are going to be doing it, my partner of propaganda. Now, Steve, you did say it'd be close. You said it'd be 48 to 52% one way or the other, and it broke 52% to leave. Were you surprised by that?
I think I was a little bit surprised. I think my own kind of biases, I wanted Remain to win, were kind of leading me towards thinking that Remain would win. When you look at all of the data, traditionally there's always a swing back to the status quo in these kind of referendums, which didn't appear to happen this time.
That was what I've been saying on other podcasts, is that there was always that 10%. I mean, the polls have been a bit all over the place. Some have been Leave, some have been Remain all the way through. Though there was always that 10% of undecided voters. Usually the consensus is that they would go with the status quo in the referendum. It doesn't seem to have happened this time.
Yeah, so I think there's two things to talk about on the polls. One is that I think it was Ipsos Mori today released their first kind of take on how they did during the referendum. And they basically said our final poll was accurate up until one final point. How we distributed those don't knows. We assumed that, like with all referendums, they would break for the status quo. They didn't. And the second thing to say is actually, when you look at the polls as a whole, there's going to be a lot of, oh, the polls don't know anything, they weren't very accurate. And yet, when you actually look at the polls as a whole throughout the period, actually, they said it was a toss-up. They said it was 50-50. It could go either way. It doesn't matter whether it was online or a phone poll.
And I suppose it's the nature of polling, isn't it? You only take 1,000 people, whether it's online or with a phone, in that certain section of time. And it depends who you ask. What seems to have decided this referendum in a big way is the vagary of the turnout as much as anything else.
I think flooding on the tube and all kinds of issues in London certainly would have had a bit of an impact. But it does appear to be that in areas where Remain needed to get the vote out, they weren't necessarily as successful as they could have been. Birmingham, for instance, where we are, turnout was something like 63%, 62-63%, maybe 64%, lower than average for the rest of the UK turnout level. So you can see there that Birmingham, which was a knife-edge vote in terms of who won, it was something like 49 to 50 points.
Yeah, I think it was 50.6.
Yeah, so it's incredibly, incredibly close. It was like 4,000 votes in it. If that turnout had been slightly higher, you could easily have seen in Birmingham, you know, it would have flipped the other way potentially, especially as the lowest kind of demographic for turnout was, perhaps unsurprisingly, young people. 18s to, I think it might be 29, was something like 58%, which is pretty good going actually for that demographic. Unfortunately, it paled in comparison to the 70 plus that the 65s and 75 pluses had. And obviously, those demographics voted more strongly for Leave.
Yeah, and Birmingham is a very young city with lots of Labour MPs as well. It's the kind of area that if we were going to vote Remain, it's the kind of area that would have needed a good solid 52, 53% in favour of staying.
Yeah, absolutely. And as for why, that's going to me is going to be the story of how this referendum was lost for the Remain side. Because it boils down to, in the areas where they needed it, they could not get out that vote. There are lots of reasons for that, I think. One, the Remain campaign itself wasn't necessarily brilliant in a lot of ways.
No.
Two, Labour have lost a lot of their kind of core vote. That can't be denied at this point. And they weren't willing to be preached at by Tories or talked to or persuaded by Labour on the issue of immigration. And here's the interesting thing, actually, is that London stayed Remain exactly as we would have expected it to. But a lot of the kind of urban kind of towns and cities as well should have been solidly Remain as well. You would have expected a much better performance based on previous experience for Remain in these metropolitan areas. And the fact that they were unable to deliver that is just a testament to why they lost this election, I feel.
Mm, it's probably a failure of organisation, I think. Maybe what we should talk about then is that kind of that divided nation, because I think you're right, one of the big divides seems to be that metropolitan... I was going to say metropolitan elites, I'm already buying into the Remain camp, the Leave campaign's propaganda. It's been a really awful referendum campaign. It's been a really toxic referendum campaign. I think what it's shown is that Britain is really divided. It's divided by rich and poor, it's divided by young and old, it's divided by London and the areas outside London. We probably both describe ourselves as reasonably metropolitan. We're reasonably middle class, quite liberal middle class outlook. You know, we have got friends from Europe, we have friends who work abroad in Europe. We don't really mind if a foreign language is spoken on the bus, but I know that in other places, you know, I could go to a working men's club in West Bromwich and it'd be completely different. In the social circle that I'm in, I knew very few Leave voters. I mean, I'm a teacher. Most teachers were for Remain anyway. There were only one or two in the staff room out of maybe 10 or 15 teachers who I spoke to who were going to leave. On Facebook timelines and Twitter, they've got a lot of people who are really scared and think that Britain's just been taken over by a load of xenophobic racists. I really don't buy into that at all.
No, I want to kind of echo the point you just made there about the kind of stratification of kind of social groups in that. I mean, I work in digital marketing, I work in the professional services sector. As far as I'm aware, there was one person in my office of about 40-odd people who voted Leave. And amongst my clients that I've spoken to today and amongst the clients that I've spoken to in the run-up to this, none of them were voting Leave. Every last one of them was bemused by the notion that anybody would. When you look at kind of like some of the anecdotal data on all of this, that's the similar kind of situation can be found amongst the kind of people who are voting Leave. They don't know anyone who's voting Remain because us middle class lefty metropolitan types aren't actually going down that working man's club.
Yeah, exactly.
To them, because we've just got completely different lives and completely different social circles, and very rarely do they meet. Class divides determine an awful lot of how you spend your time and who you spend your time with. And it's that class divide, I think, which has led to this kind of inability to comprehend either way.
Andy Burnham said that the Remain campaign was too much Hampstead and not enough Hull. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, talking about working class interest reminds me of football in the Premier League. And I always think that one of the best things the Remain campaign could have talked about is the effect this would have on the Premier League. Now, the Premier League did put out a statement this week saying they were for Remain. The amount of Premier League footballers who, if they were not EU citizens, would not be eligible for an EU work permit. And I'm not, my knowledge is a bit sketchy, but I think it's about the percentage of games you play for your country. So players like Riyad Mahrez, who was Leicester's great French player this season, helped them win the Premier League, he wouldn't be eligible for a work permit if he wasn't an EU citizen. And so the amount of Premier League footballers we could lose is surely a big trump for the Remain campaign. I didn't see it talked about at all.
I do think one of the kind of the flaws of the kind of Remain campaign, one of the big ones was they started talking economics, which is fine. They started talking Project Fear, that's fine. And actually, a certain element of Project Fear was necessary to this kind of campaign, given what they were going up against. So anybody who starts saying, oh, we should have made a much more positive campaign, yes, to a certain extent, but that doesn't mean you're not actually saying things are going to be terrible, guys, because that's one we've seen today with the market.
You need the carrot and stick.
Yeah, exactly. And we had a lot of the stick, but not very much of the carrot. And that carrot should have been kind of pointing out the contributions that the EU does make. Unfortunately, some of those things, which would have been a lot more obvious, couldn't be used by the Conservatives. So, for instance, whenever there's a flood, there is basically emergency disaster relief available for any EU member to apply for to help deal with the situation. So when Kendal is flooding up north every summer, as seems to be the case these days, all of the money that comes to, a lot of the money that comes in from that EU. In Cornwall, which voted quite heavily to leave, an awful lot of the money that they get for infrastructure comes from the EU. The average person doesn't actually know what the EU does, because unless there's a giant blue plaque which says paid for by the European Union, You don't know. You don't see what they do. And that's, I think, the kind of the root cause, is that it wasn't obvious to a lot of the population what the kind of net benefits were. That's one of the reasons why that 350 million figure was so effective, is because it basically set up the notion of 350 million, we're paying this, what are we getting out of it?
Mm.
And when your response is to go, oh, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's not the accurate figure, it's only 195 million,
mm.
Correct response to that figure should have been, yeah, and here's what we get.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that you have, if you want to remain in the single market, as it seems most Brexit people do, you'd probably have to pay a lot of that anyway.
Yeah.
But also, I think going back to your point about it can't be Conservatives making those arguments, it's only really Labour that can make the argument that it's not immigration that's harming the NHS. It is austerity and it's spending cuts. But it wasn't an argument that was made very often.
No, and I think that boils down to the fact that Labour wanted to have a separate campaign.
Hmm.
Completely, and this is one of the kind of the big issues I have, is that you in effect had probably four separate in campaigns actually working at the same time. You've Britain Stronger in Europe, which to a certain extent is also the Conservative in campaign, but they're still doing their own little thing, so we can still count that as a separate one. You've got Labour in, you've got Liberal Democrat in, you've got Green in, you've got SNP in.
And there just wasn't that coherent message.
Yeah, there was no coherent message behind any of it for the most part. The Lib Dems trying to make kind of a more positive case for Europe along the lines of what I'm talking about. Mm. You've got the Tories with Project Fear. You can't see the air quotes I'm using, but they're there. Labour with whatever the hell Labour had, and that's the part of the issue, is that I can't think of how to actually describe it. The only kind of main elements that I can think of from Labour's campaign are Corbyn appearing on TV and him being half-hearted in his support, kind of making the put and spending half of his time, you know, criticising TTIP. Now, whatever you might think about TTIP, the time to bring that up is not in the middle of a referendum where you are supposed to be leading a party which is on the side of remaining in the EU.
Yeah, I think we should talk more about Labour's lacklustre campaign and Corbyn specifically a bit later on. But I always thought if we had a referendum on the EU, one of the reasons why we wrote to remain is because the Remain camp would pick a big figure. It would be like the AV campaign. You pick a big figure. It might be these million jobs are a product of the single market, or this amount is the benefit that immigration brings, or this amount is what the single market gives us. And you repeat that figure endlessly and endlessly and endlessly. Now, there was, as you said, we started with the economics. There was this figure, $4,000 or whatever it was, that each family would lose out. And that disappeared after the first couple of days, when no one really took it very seriously. Whereas actually the campaign that had that figure and repeated it endlessly was the Leave campaign. Not surprisingly, it's the same chaps who run the Leave campaign who ran the No to AV, mm-hmm. £250 million, you know, we need a baby, not a new voting system. Leave won because it had the better campaign. It had a much clearer message, but it also had a much better slogan. Take our country back. It's much better than Stronger In, because we'll Stronger In to do what? I mean, it feels like that going, a recurring feature of our podcast so far has been the fact that EU has no clear purpose. And that was never more clear than when they were trying to find arguments in favour of it.
Yeah.
Now, we're both pro-EU, but I think we both agree, well, the case to remain in is more a 55-60%. It's not an 80-20, it's not a 90-10. You know, on balance, the EU is a good thing.
Yeah.
There are enough good reasons you could come up with, but the Remain campaign didn't come up with enough of them.
Yeah, and I think it was Stephen Tall who was the first of the three-on-three debates on was happening. He basically tweeted out and said, Leave is to take back control as blank is to remain. And he basically said, in order for Remain to win, they need to fill in that blank. And they didn't fill in that blank. Basically, what they let the Leave campaign do was fill in that blank for them. The Remain campaign were very bad at actually rebutting points. As a general thing, Leave are atrocious at this as well, because every time that someone came out with a fact or figure which was against them, it was an establishment stitch-up.
Well, experts know nothing.
Exactly. But Remain should have been able to handle things a lot better. I think one of the biggest missed opportunities for them was the minute the talk and the debate turned to immigration. Every single city, every single poster board, every single talking point should have been the following: no immigration, no NHS.
And that's it. You can make those arguments about the NHS. You can make the arguments, actually, I think it's something like a net contribution of £10 billion.
Yep.
I've seen Yvette Cooper making the argument that we should have a migrant fund where you put those extra taxes into extra areas where maybe immigration is an issue and some services are being stretched. And you could make that very public. There are lots of things you could do.
I mean, perhaps another one of the things that would be really, really good would be to just have a poster which is just two war veterans. One is a Sikh from fighting from World War II. One is a current day Gurkha. And you've got, we are both immigrants. We have both served our country. Immigrants serving our country, not destroying it. You know?
It makes me really sad the Remain campaign didn't do that. I don't know if it was because it was too scared. I don't know if it's because they didn't think it would poll well. I saw something in the Sunday Times saying that Jeremy Corbyn removed all references to migrants from Labour Inn's campaign literature. Maybe it is a good time to talk about Jeremy Corbyn because he is the bearded elephant that's lurking in the room. I'm not surprised that Jeremy Corbyn led a lacklustre campaign because, as we've said before, he's not terribly favouring being in the EU. What this has shown is that Labour is disconnected, that when Labour does well, it can unite. You need those two groups together. You need the metro, you need the intelligentsia, you need the working class. And Labour doesn't have that. They've got the intelligentsia. No, Corbyn's almost the epitome of that. He's got the lefty students. He doesn't have that working class base. And that's obvious in terms of, as you were saying, those cities that haven't voted Remain, when maybe you'd like to think they would do. When you see those concerns about immigration, which aren't really echoed in the party, it's not really surprising Labour's left its vote behind and couldn't get its vote to turn out on that issue.
For years it was, don't talk about it. Beyond a certain point, Labour stopped trying to challenge because they knew it was dodgy ground for them, so they then just ignored it or tried to pander in the way with Ed Miliband with his take immigration control mug.
Yes.
And it was like, well, what does that even mean?
Well, and I think as well it's that not challenging that because you just assume you've got that vote locked up and there's nowhere else to go. And actually, now there is the rise of UKIP, there is somewhere else to go. And I think they are going to go there in bigger numbers. But either you have to make that positive case or you have to reframe that debate.
Yeah.
And how that happens is a different podcast, really, because we could talk about that for hours.
And we probably will do.
And we probably will do. So that lacklustre campaign means Remain can't get out the voters it needs.
Yeah.
Let's go on then to, is this an anti-establishment matter? One of the things that Roy Jenkins said in 1975 when being asked why the British people voted to remain in the EEC is that they'd taken the advice of people they were used to following, but reflects the 70s where people had quite respect for their MPs, was more deferential culture to MPs. Obviously wasn't the case in this referendum. It felt to me like the Remain campaign, they trotted out their list of experts. They had Mark Carney, they had Barack Obama, they had their economists. And when that didn't work, they weren't really sure what to do.
Yeah, there was a revolt against something. I think it was a revolt against the status quo, but I don't think you can say it's a revolt against the elites, considering the people in charge of the Leave campaign in all aspects are members of that elite. It's not very often I say this, but I think Paul Mason actually put it quite succinctly. I think he said it was something along the lines of, this is a working class revolt, but it's a working class revolt engineered by elites for their purpose, not for the benefit of the working classes.
Boris Johnson went to Eton and Oxford. Nigel Farage went to Dulwich College, which is fee-paying. Michael Gove went to Oxford. They're not anti-establishment figures. In the three podcasts before the referendum of this kind of wave of populism that was going across Europe, going across America as well, do you think it feeds into that wave of populism?
I think it does, actually. One of the things that I stumbled across today, something from Lord Ashcroft, which when you broke it down, it was kind of like what people's opinions of certain things like multiculturalism. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Leavers had a much worse opinion of the internet. They had a much worse opinion of feminism. They had a much worse opinion of multiculturalism. And you look at that, and you look at what's happening in the US with the supporters of Donald Trump, and you can see clear parallels between it. The 538 podcast, election podcast, which is Nate Silver, Nate Silver's website in the US, which talks polling data and things like that. They did an episode about a week or so ago on Brexit. They basically said that it does appear to be that there's a very similar kind of demographic behind the kind of Trump and Leave camps in the UK and the US. If you look at it a bit even deeper, you can see other things which are similar as well. There was a piece a few months back, I think it was in The Atlantic, which was looking at kind of like the psychology behind Trump supporters. And one of the things that they found was that they scored very highly on authoritarianism, basically a belief in strong leadership. And you look at that and you look at what their core support was. Again, it was those kind of the people scored highly on kind of that authoritarian scale. So it's very much is part of that wave of, for lack of a better term, anti-elite populism, which you can see. So I think, yeah, all of these things are connected. And I think the first country to work out how to deal with it advances quicker than everyone else.
I can't tell if it's, like we've talked before about those people left behind by globalisation, or if this is like the final kind of baby boomers generation sticking it to the young people, this generation that's had free healthcare, free education, free university for years, and then had the benefit of the EU for 40 years, and now have, as soon as the millennials are coming to the age where they could use that free movement of labour, taking it away from them. If it's maybe people who are more secure in their jobs and families have taken it away, rather than it being people who are necessarily disenfranchised.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. Let's just take into account the fact that we had something like a, 72% turnout. What were we for the general election? 65?
I think it was about 65. This is the highest since 92.
Yeah, so
no, not only John Major has been this inspiring for the British public in 25 years.
God. but yeah, so it's an incredibly high turnout level for an election of any kind. So you know what? That's a good thing. And if the people who turned out happened to be a bit more disenfranchised and happened to therefore vote against the status quo because they didn't feel that they were getting anything out of it, again, as I said earlier, they are getting something out of it. They're just not aware of it in a lot of instances because a lot of the benefits aren't obvious.
Well, it's the fact that the second most Google thing in the UK today has been
What is the EU,
which would be hilarious if it didn't make me want to either cry or shake something.
I think one of the other things that's going to come out of this is there's going to be a certain type of lefty and quote-unquote progressives who are going to kind of use this to kind of say, oh, look, the people are being lied to, it's time for... it's all Murdoch's fault, yada, yada, yada.
We need state education, we need kind of EU classes.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of stuff. And it's just like, for the most part, actually, you don't need that. This was a really fine vote. This could have easily gone the other way. All it required was a couple of things. One, a better run campaign from the Remain side, I think. But also, the people who supported Remain not calling people all leavers racists, that would have been a good start. It's entirely possible to be concerned about immigration purely based on, I do not think that we have the infrastructure and capacity to cope. Now, we do have the infrastructure, we do have that capacity. Britain is not full. But
you need to do it in that art.
You need to actually demonstrate that. You can't just sit there and go, oh, you're being racist. And then when they don't listen to you for that, accuse them of being dumb. That's the exact opposite of winning friends and influencing people. That's how to lose friends and alienate people. And you can see it again in the reaction to the result, where there's been this call for kind of London independence. Okay, so you haven't gotten your way in London. You voted for Remain. So now you want to make sure that you're getting your way. Now, yes, you voted more strongly for Remain. You voted 60% or something like that for it. That's still 40-odd% of your city which didn't. But because you're enlightened, they don't count.
It's about becoming united again. As you said, like, I think you made a really good point. It's about how you harness that
populist anti-politics? Yeah. How do you turn it to something constructive?
There's a wonderful thing which Tim Montgomery kind of tweeted out early on this morning, where he just basically said, oh my God, Farage is on TV again. Where the hell is Gove? Where the hell is Johnson? Where the hell is Gisella? Where are all of the leading kind of Leave people at this point? We need to reassure and unify the country. There are 48% of this country did not vote to leave. We cannot be having Nigel Farage as the face of this victory. And again, this is quite interesting. Again, when I was listening to the radio this morning, I listened to Planet Rock on my DAB. The quote that came through on the headline news was not David Cameron, was not Boris Johnson, it was not Michael Gove, it was Nigel Farage declaring victory. And that is the issue that you in terms of unifying this country, you have to approach. Most people, you know, I suspect a lot of Remain people aren't going to like Gove and aren't going to like Johnson. But there's a sort of grudging kind of, they're not the devil themselves.
I know, I'm a teacher. Michael Gove gets pretty close. he just needs a...
But Nigel Farage, when he's standing in front of what in effect looks like Nazi propaganda, when he makes a statement, says, "We have had a revolution with not a single gunshot fired," when just last week, Joe Cox was murdered by after being shot and stabbed to death by a fascist.
Yes.
People are going to get pissed off with that, and quite rightly so. And even like some of the more kind of sensible kind of leavers, like Ian Martin, holy hell, what the hell is that? That's just absolutely despicable. So in terms of unifying the country and moving forward, it very much is on the Leave side to actually present to us, in effect, a reason to engage. To a certain extent, bits and pieces of this have happened. Dan Hannan, the Conservative MEP, an arch Eurosceptic and Leaver, has kind of turned around and said it's a very close vote. That probably means we can't get away with banning all immigration, which suits Dan Hannan just fine because he's not actually one of those banning immigration type of Eurosceptics. But that presents a massive issue then for them, because you've just run a campaign all about taking back control of our borders.
I suppose now we're in the battle of interpretation.
Yeah.
You know, the vote has been done, and then it's what does it actually mean? And that's going to be the interesting thing as we go in weeks and months. I mean, it was Joe Johnson, I think, actually, Boris's brother, who tweeted, you know, big decision, we've got to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what's got to happen now. We're not going to talk about what happens next. That's to work out in the weeks and months after this. This is just, you know, first draft of history stuff. It does look like now David Cameron, we've recorded this on Friday, David Cameron resigned today. His Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty isn't going to be a vote until the new Prime Minister takes office in October, which means we'll be a member of the EU until October, and then see how we go.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like 2016 has been a bad year for celebrity deaths. Ronnie Corbett, David Bowie, Terry Wogan, Prince, Muhammad Ali. Maybe the EU will be the next one. We'll find out soon. Bye for now, I'll be with you next week.
See ya.
We'll be right back.